discuss here. She asked, there have been some pretty interesting advances in Bell inequality experiments in the last year. People have managed to close the all of the interesting loopholes, so-called, in these experiments for the first time. Now, Bell's inequalities were developed in the 60s, and there were some initial experiments in the 70s and 80s. But people started thinking about locality loopholes and detection loopholes. So I'll tell you what that stuff means. Anyway, what I decided to do, though, was tell you about our own experiment, which came out a few years ago, maybe two or three. It contains discussion of the loopholes, but I can tell you a little bit more about what we did locally in here in Waterloo. And if you have any questions about the other experiments, I'm happy to discuss those as well. OK. So this is an experiment that we did at Waterloo. It was quite a big collaboration for us. I mean, it's not CERN, but for an optics experiment to have 15 co-authors, it's a lot of people. So it was work that I did with, so most of the people here are group members from my group and this guy's group, Thomas Yenevine. And this is Chris Irvin. So he was the postdoc who was the project manager, I would say, for this experiment. All right, so we've talked a little bit about entanglement. You probably know by now that entangled states can manifest correlations that are strange. They're things that we can't describe using classical physics. And we often talk about EPR paradox or Bell's inequalities. But in this talk, I like this description of the problem. So this is a kind of a game that was, it's a way of describing the so-called, well, I'll get to that. So it's basically, you know, a kind of logic problem. So anyone recognize this guy anymore? No, old people?
Oh, my God.
Okay, so this is Dr. Evil. And what he's going to do is trap three physicists in his, you know, evil lair, whatever, Schrodinger, Pauli, and Einstein. And he's, you know, it's kind of like one of these logic puzzles where, you know, tomorrow morning something's going to happen, and if you can't satisfy my puzzle, you're all dead. So what he's going to do, so in the morning he's going to separate them and put them all in different rooms so they can't talk to each other anymore. And when they're separated, they're going to be asked one of these sets of questions. So in scenario one, they're all going to be asked the question, what is why? Okay, it's a stupid question. It lines up very well with, you know, Pauli observables. This is, you know, this is something that you wouldn't just ask the, anyway, bear with me. The only possible answers for the questions are plus or minus one. So he's going to ask Pauli, in this scenario, each of them, what is why, and all they're allowed to reply is plus one or minus one. In scenario two, one person will be asked what is why, and the other two will be asked what is x. And again, the only possible answers that they can say are plus one or minus one. Now, they win the game, they'll be freed. If in scenario one, the product of their answers is plus one, so multiplying these answers together gives plus one. And in scenario two, the product of their answers has to be minus one. And if they don't satisfy that, then they're dead. Okay, so that's the challenge. That's clear. All right, so in the morning, this is the table of things they want. If they're asked why, the product of their answers had better be minus one. And in scenario two, there are these three possible sets of questions. One of them, we don't know which, will be asked what is why. The other two will be asked what is x. And in these cases here, the product of their answers had better be minus 1. Okay, so here's a possible strategy. They get together, and they say, all right, well, no matter what we're asked, we're going to answer minus 1. So if they happen to be asked question 1 and they all answer minus 1, then the product of their answers is minus 1 and they lose. But in the other case, all three possibilities, they'll win. Okay? In these cases, they want the product of their answers to be minus 1. Okay, so that's not great. They want to improve their odds. So what about another possible strategy? Pauli and Einstein decide, okay, we'll always answer minus 1. And then Schrodinger's going to answer plus 1 if he's asked the question y, or minus 1 if he's asked the question x. All right, so now they're trying to be clever, right? This didn't work before. So Pauli and Einstein say are going to both answer minus 1. And Schrodinger will answer plus 1 if he's asked y. And so that straightens out that problem. Okay, so they win if they get the first question. And let me see. If x, x, y. Schrodinger answers plus 1. Yeah, so Schrodinger's asked question x, so he answers minus 1. Pauli and Einstein always answer minus 1. So they win in this question. If it's x, y, x, yeah, they win. But in the last one, they lose. Okay? And it turns out that if they try any strategy like this, of assigning these outcomes for their questions beforehand, plus or minus 1, they can only answer 3 of the 4 questions right, no matter what strategy they use. Okay? The way you can see that this is an impossible set of constraints to satisfy if they predetermine their answers is to just look at these relations a little bit more closely. So, right, so they got the product of the y's, they want plus 1, and then these kinds of combinations that have 1 y and 2 x's, they want minus 1. But if you look at each column here in this side, there's 2 y's and 2 x's. So no matter what they choose, if they choose minus 1 or plus 1, the product of their answers in this scenario, if you multiply them together, will be x squared times y squared, which is a positive number. Okay, and that's the same in all of these columns, right? There's 2 y's and 2 x's in each column. If you take the product of the numbers on the right side, it's minus 1. So there's no way to fill in this table with plus 1's and minus 1's such that plus 1, the product of the multiplying all of the answers on the right side, which will be plus 1, will equal minus 1. So they're basically, any strategy like this, they're screwed. Okay, and this is a nice example of how these local realistic models for nature work. Right? They basically assume that properties of systems have certain properties that are predetermined, and measurements just go in and reveal them. Okay, so what they need to do to win somehow is they need to coordinate their decisions, but they need to do so in a way without communicating. It sounds impossible. Well, it turns out that it's not. And the solution is to use an entangled state called a GHZ or Greenberger-Horn-Zeilinger state. And there are lots of ways of writing this, but I've written this out in the right way to match our story. So it's a three-particle entangled state. So we haven't talked about that yet. But I'm using the spin notation. So this is up, up, up. These are the plus z eigenstates of spin. So this would be like H polarization for photons. Minus I down, down, down. So that would be like minus I V, V, V. And it turns out that this state is a simultaneous eigenstate of the four operators corresponding to the questions that I put on the previous page. So for example, the YYY acting on this GHZ state gives me plus one times the GHZ state. So what this means, because it's an eigenstate of the operator YYY, if Schrodinger, Pauli, and Einstein had this state separated, they don't have to be together, and they measure spin along the y direction, and just say whatever outcomes they locally get, which will each be random, plus one or minus one, the product of their outcomes is guaranteed to be plus one. Okay. So they don't have any control. There's no predetermined. In fact, it's totally random what each one of them will say. But this is a this is an eigenstate of this operator with an extremal eigenvalue here. So the product of the outcomes has to be this value. And you can see that the rest of the pattern is from that table is repeated. The same state is also an eigenstate of yxx with eigenvalue minus 1, which means that if they measured y, Schrodinger measured y, Pauli and Einstein measured x, the product of their local measurements would be minus 1. So they would satisfy this Dr. Evil's challenge. And that works for all of the four conditions in that. So it's a way of using entanglement to do something that we can't do classically. Seemingly impossible task. It's pretty cool. All right, so this game is a little bit ridiculous, but basically it's the argument that was presented by Greenberger, Horn, and Zeilinger in this paper here, 1989. And it's sometimes referred to as an all or nothing test against local hidden variable descriptions. It's slightly different than a regular Bell experiment, because a Bell experiment, usually you have to get statistics. You have to measure something many times, where these GHZ arguments can, in principle, rule out a local hidden variable description in just one shot, at least theoretically. The problem, though, is that the GHZ argument is based on perfect correlation. So what Merman did, and this is the basis of Merman's inequality, which I put in the title, is he relaxed the requirement for perfect correlation and turned this into a kind of Bell inequality, but for three particles that allows for some imperfection. So it looks like this. I'll explain where this comes from. So if you've seen the Clauser-Horn Shimoni-Holt Bell inequality, the CHSH Bell inequality, it kind of looks like this. These quantities E, A, B, C. This is the three-body correlation of measurement outcomes for measurement settings A, B, and C. So if the outcomes are plus or minus one, it's basically just the expectation value of the product of the outcomes. So in this idealized case, if we could do everything perfectly, when the settings were YYY, the correlation would just be this number. If there's imperfection, we're just going to average the number. Basically, it'll be related to the number of times we measure plus one minus the number of times we measure minus one. Oops. It's okay. So the first time that this was measured was actually around, it's probably using this almost exact same source that we, that's a little different. It's a different setup. It was done back in Zeilinger's group in 2000. And I don't want to talk about this too much, because I'm going to explain a little bit more on how this works. But I just want to, I don't want to imply that our experiment was the first to see these correlations in an experiment. All right, so when doing a Bell experiment, typically we're trying to measure correlations between two locations that are far apart. There's no way for one location to communicate with the other. And we're trying to measure something about, the the correlations in nature. So basically, I would say in the in analog with the Dr. Evil story, there's something called the locality loophole. So if the measurement stations aren't separated, causally disconnected outside of each other's light cone, then there's the possibility that they would communicate with each other and coordinate their results. So this, in that story, this is a little bit like if Schrodinger and Einstein had a radio to talk to each other to coordinate results. So you want to rule out the possibility of doing that in an experiment. Otherwise, you open up a loophole where nature could appear non-local when in fact things aren't. It could appear to violate the assumptions of a local hidden variable model when it actually isn't. The other is the detection loophole. So this is the idea that somehow detector efficiency isn't high enough, then nature could be, there are ways that nature could be conspiring to only let us detect the particles that have a high correlation, somehow ignoring the others that have a lower correlation. So it's another way that nature could appear to violate a local hidden variable model when in fact it isn't. It violates something called the fair sampling hypothesis, which is that the measured sample of the particles that you see in an experiment are representative of the whole. And the analog in the Schrodinger-Pauli-Einstein experiment would be that if they were allowed the possibility of just refusing to answer the question and getting a new set of questions, right? They would be able to, in an extreme example, they'd be able to win that game no problem because they could, the night before, just say, well, we're only going to answer the questions if we all get asked the question, what is why? If anyone gets asked the question, what is X, refuse to answer, and we'll get a new set of questions. And we'll keep doing that until we get the questions we want. Right? That's basically how these detection loophole experiments, loopholes work. Okay, so we can see how, Schrodinger, Einstein, and Pauli could game the system if they were allowed to affect a detection loophole or violate locality. And freedom of choice, that's related to locality. It has more to do with, instead of the measurement stations being separated, it somehow allows the measurement to affect what's coming out of the source in the experiment. So this would basically be, I'm trying to come up with these analogies on the spot. It would be like if the choice of measurement that they made could influence the questions they'd be asked, I think. That might not be quite true. Anyway, it'll make more sense. Maybe it doesn't have a good analog in this story. So in our experiment, we were aiming to close these loopholes in a test of Merman's inequality, not detection, which I don't know how, the technology isn't there, isn't even close to do that. So if you think about the locality loophole, you already have a pretty big problem. In order to choose a basis to measure in, change something, register a photon detection, and write it onto the memory of a computer, it takes a certain amount of time, roughly a microsecond. If you convert a microsecond, photons, they move fast, right? If you convert a microsecond into distance, you're on the kilometer scale. So just, very roughly, what we have to do is generate three entangled photons at some location, and then we have to separate them out so that they're all a kilometer apart so that we can do the measurements. So that's essentially what we were trying to do in this experiment. Then you need a source of randomness at each location. Anyone recognize this? All right, this was like the most awesome game on The Price is Right. Plinko, this guy would have, guessed the prices of cans of soup and then got a bunch of chips. And then he puts them in, this is what's called a Galton board. So they drop chips in the bottom and it goes bing, 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 bing. And lands in bins at the bottom. And the middle bin was like $10,000. It's pretty exciting stuff. Anyway, we didn't build a Plinko board, but we needed some way of generating randomness from some event. And the light cone from this event is going to reach the other measurement stations on the scale of microseconds. So we have to do everything at this location very quickly, and then we need Plinko boards and bomb barkers at each measurement station so we can do the same things there. Not sure this is the best way to explain this, but it's kind of amusing. If we had done the experiment this way, that would have been amazing. We didn't. All right. So with these locality loopholes, people have done experiments with pairs of photons. There was a famous experiment by Alain Aspect and Philippe Granger in the 80s, where they tried to have time-varying analyzers to determine the measurement settings. And that experiment, groundbreaking at the time, was criticized because the measurement settings weren't determined randomly. They were predictable. So another experiment was done in the late 90s, around 2000, by Gregor Weiss and Thomas Jenevein in Anton Zeilinger's group, where they basically did what I think people regard now as the definitive test. We use the same technology in our experiment here. So you'll get a sense of what they did. But we have a problem. So with three particle entangled states, we're behind the eight ball in several ways. So the most significant one is rate. So as I said before, we can generate entangled photon pairs at a rate of megahertz. But entangled triples, we can only generate at a rate of hertz. So we have a million times less signal to work with, which is bad. We have to separate these photons over a long distance, and anytime you're sending light in a channel like this, there's loss. So we have three photons, we're going to have loss cubed instead of loss squared. Owing to the nature of how we generated the photons, we have a lot more background light. And then it's just a complicated thing. This was probably the most complex experiment that I've ever done. It's way more complicated than the kinds of things we do in the lab. And then there were some self-inflicted problems, which I think this picture nicely summarizes, which was the time of year we ended up getting things ready to go. So we also, we're trying to do things in the middle of winter, which actually, is in some sense a wonderful time to do these experiments because, as you'll see, we did them mostly at night, and you have a lot more night to deal with in the winter. This is a great, I like this photo. So the way this worked, we combined kind of three sets of technology that people had been developing independently at IQC. So Gregor, when he was here, and Ray, together with Chris, who was a PhD student with Ray, developed a free space quantum key distribution experiment. So they were sending photons from a building on the Waterloo campus to Ray's office here in Perimeter. I think the telescope is still in there. To be able to establish key between the former IQC building and NPI. So this is an example of one of the telescopes. This one was designed for our experiment, but Chris was really good at building these things and making them work. This is a photo from my lab. I had a student at the time, Jonathan Lavoie, who spent a lot of time trying to optimize a three-photon entangled photon source for rate. So when I said three-photon entangled states we can produce at a rate of hertz, if I go back to that Zeilinger experiment, I didn't put it. The count rate that they had in this experiment was hundredths of hertz. So we had, in the end, we had 40 hertz. So we had 400 to 1,000 times more faster rate or higher flux than they had in this experiment. And he spent a lot of time getting that to work. Thomas built a lot of the electronics that we needed for this experiment. Now, when we do these correlation experiments in the lab, like the teleportation experiment, usually we have a cable that we take two cables from the detectors and we put them into the same box and we do coincidence measurements. We have boxes that basically you can think of as doing an AND gate between two detections, and it gives you a click every time two detections come in at the same time. You can't do that in this experiment because everything has to be registered locally. So one of the pieces of equipment that Thomas built and is actually has a company to sell them now is a timestamping device. So when a photon is registered, instead of just recording that there was a click, it actually writes down the time down to nanosecond precision. So there's very precise timing, and this electronics record not just an event, but the time that an event happens very precisely. So that was one of the pieces of equipment that we needed. Another one that we needed was a so-called, if you want, one of the technologies that doesn't get a lot of credit in quantum information science, but probably deserves to be more so, is the idea that quantum measurements can be, at least according to the theory, random. So we can build a quantum random number generator in a really simple way just by taking a single photon and a beam splitter. This technically creates a superposition state or an entangled state between these two modes with two detectors. And the photon will either be measured click here at this detector or here at this detector. You can call those zeros or ones. According to the theory, that's a random event, something that's not predictable at all in advance. So we use some random number generators, again developed by Thomas, that are based on this really simple principle. And what we did with those is we could trigger this device, it's called a Pockel cell. Basically, it's like a wave plate, but the optical thickness of the wave plate depends on a voltage that's applied to it. So basically, if you apply no voltage, it doesn't do anything to the polarization. If you apply a voltage pulse of about a kilovolt across it, all of a sudden it behaves like a half wave plate. And you can, with the right kind of electronic switch, you can trigger this thing and change it from one state to the other in just a few nanoseconds. So here's the source that we used in the experiment. I have the rate here, 0.01 hertz, 40. And so it's like 4,000 times. Yeah, 4,000 times more brighter source, sorry. So here's the source that Jonathan built. So the laser's up here. We pumped two down conversion sources. These work kind of like the Quiet one. They're a little bit different, but not in a very significant way. And the photons that come out, we combine on a polarizing beam splitter. So the way that this works basically is you have two independent Bell pairs. So this is the state from source one. And then you have a state from source two. That's also in a Bell state. So this is not Greenberger-Horn-Zeilinger state. But if you put a polarizing beam splitter here, then the way that works is if both photons are horizontal, they go through. If both photons are vertical, they both get reflected. Okay? But if they're different, if I have a horizontal and a vertical, horizontal goes through, vertical gets reflected, they both go the same way. So if I expand this state out, let's multiply this out. This product of two bell pairs is this state here, but these two states have different polarizations for these middle two photons. And if you post-select on photons being in all four of these locations, these two terms from this state are ignored. So we're left with just a four photon GHZ state. And if I just project one of the photons onto the plus state, say photon one, that's my four photon GHZ, then I'm left with a three photon GHZ state, which is what we wanted. And so that's basically how this thing works. So the two bell pairs, here's the polarizing beam splitter. This photon is just projected onto the plus state, and the remaining three are in this GHZ state that we want. The fact that we need to use this post-selection, though, means that we don't have a hope of violating or of closing the detection loophole. Our efficiency is too low.
Excuse me, how do you split up the two photons that come out of one?
Here?
Part of the beam splitter, yeah.
No, we only want the cases where they are split up. So if they come out the... If they come out the same port,
yeah,
we just don't see them.
Okay. If two horizontal go in.
They're coming from different sides. That's this picture. So if they come from different sides, this one goes through and that one goes through.
Wouldn't I expect a homomandal thing happening?
It's a polarizing beam splitter.
Sorry.
Yeah. So polarizing beam splitter to these polarizations is basically having nothing there. And to these ones, it's like having a perfect mirror. So this is the, so that's the source. We can do something called quantum state tomography. Aggie knows a lot about this. This is a measure of the density operator of the state that we're producing. So this is... This is the real part. This is the imaginary part. This is the diagonal. So the size of the elements is represented by the height of the bars. And basically, this thing has some population for HHH and VVV. So that's good. That's what we want. And then these off-diagonal elements are sometimes called the coherences. This one looks like when he took this one, it was close to a minus sign between those two, but it's still an entangled state. Actually, can't remember. We might have used the minus sign in the experiment. I don't remember. Anyway, the important thing is that the rate here is like 39 hertz, as compared with a hundredth of a hertz for the previous pan result, and that was crucial. So what we did in our experiment. Is this thing was in my lab on the North Campus of Waterloo. We took two of the photons and we put them in fibers and we took them up to the roof. So this was a little dome just to protect things from the elements. And there's a couple telescopes here that we used to send each photon out to the measurement stations via free space link. So just basically, we just sent the photons, you know, through the air. To the receivers. So the whole experiment kind of looks like this altogether. So this is the North Campus. You know, we're like here now. This is where IQC. This is one of our buildings, the RAC building. It's been each circle has been blown up a little bit. So this is the edge of the North Campus of the university. So the source was in this building in RAC, all this yellow stuff. And that dome that I showed you was on the roof of the building here. So what we did is we took one of the photons from the experiment, and we just stored it in the lab in a loop. Okay? So we got away with only having to send two photons a kilometer, not three. And the irony of it is this fiber was the worst transmission of all the links in the experiment. So we would have been better off if we'd sent all the photons over these links. Anyway, so these telescopes we use to send to these trailers, which are just like boxes out in these cornfields where we had the measurement stuff, and they were heated. So the people that were sitting there, they had internet, so they could watch hockey games, and they were heated, so they were okay. So just to kind of put everything together, the source was in the lab. One of the photons got put into this loop. The Pockel cell here would determine the measurement setting, and then we would measure with photon counting detectors and record time tags at each location. Similarly, once we'd send the photons to the roof, this circle here, use an optical free space link to send it to the trailer. Same idea, there's a quantum random number generator triggering a Pockel cell, detections, and measuring time tags. Those are the events that we found. And in the end, we want to look at the correlations in those events to measure the Merman inequality. There's a fourth actor in this experiment, which comes about from trying to keep everything separate, and that's our random number generator, Randy. So we named this Alice, Bob, and Charlie, and then I hope this takes off. It's a pretty cool name. So Randy was just a random number generator that we had to move away from the source. I'll explain why maybe in a minute. But Randy was just sending signals of zeros and ones to tell Alice what basis to measure in. Okay? So we would have liked to have put that random number generator in the lab, but then the random numbers are not causally disconnected from the source, and we would run into a freedom of choice loophole. So that's why Randy is where he is. So what we did in the experiment is in deciding where to put all these things. So these weren't just randomly plunked down locations. We had to consider kind of the space-time diagram for this whole experiment. So the idea is that the source is, we imagine that the source produces a pair of photons at time t equals 0 at position x equals 0. And then this will be the forward light cone of a state creation event. This is the backward light cone of the state creation event. Bob now is at some position, let me see this picture, 700 meters away from the source. So this location here is about 700 meters from the lab. And Bob has to make a decision of what basis he's going to measure his photon in prior to an event. We want that to be outside of the light cone, the forward light cone of the state creation, so that somehow the state creation can't influence what measurement choice Bob wants to make in his experiment. So we ensured with the timing that Bob has to make a choice somewhere in this time, between in this reference frame, 1 and 2, must be microseconds. And then finally the photon arrives from the source, which has to be inside the light cone, forward light cone of the source, and Bob will then make his measurement on this photon. So this gap here between the latest time that Bob chooses his basis and the forward light cone of the state creation has a gap of 300 nanoseconds. So that's kind of our margin for this freedom of choice loophole in this one, for this characteristic. Similarly, Bob could have made his basis choice at this point as early as about 1 microsecond. So now we have to consider the forward light cone of that and make sure that Alice is done measuring her particle prior to the possibility of information about Bob's measurement choice reaching her lab. And Alice is co-located with the source, so that's why this is all here. And There's lots of time, almost a microsecond gap. Okay, so with that experiment, there were these four locations, and I won't go through all of them. But that leads to basically six slices, six pairs of things, of events going on at the different locations in this experiment that we had to all make sure were separate. So that's what this picture is showing. This is, you know, the blue is the related to Charlie's basis choice, Randy making, anyway, there are a lot of events that we had to make sure were separate. And in the end, this particular arrangement was a balance between making sure that everything was causally disconnected, not having to go to too far a distance, and to make sure that there were actual locations there where we could put our stuff for a year. Okay? So the only thing to take away from this is that when you go to three particles, especially the way we did it, it's complicated. When we did our experiment, we took those measurements, the local measurements, and brought the hard drives together and found over the course of a 1 hour experiment about 2,500 counts, which is actually a lot. We're pretty happy with this. The Merman inequality is such that only half of those are useful for one inequality. But from that, we could calculate these four correlations. And we were able to find a Merman value of 2.77, where the threshold or it's considered a violation of Merman's inequality once we get larger than 2. So with this tiny error bar based on the count statistics, we weren't even close to this. We were well above violating this. It was actually amazing. This is these correlations depicted at bar charts. So as long as they're all above a half, that would be enough to violate. We're well above that. Okay. I think I'm on time. So just in this talk and then the previous hour, I kind of gave you an overview of how quantum optics can be used for quantum information science. We talked a fair amount about polarization and how to do transformations and measurements and generate entanglement in that system. This example of experimental teleportation let us kind of put together those parts. And then in the second part, I talked about this experiment that we did here at Waterloo, combining the expertise of several different groups together into kind of a very cool, very fun, at times frustrating, collaborative project. Everyone, if you ever see, I don't know if you know Chris Pugh or who's still around. Not too many now, but the students who worked on this project were amazing. And after they got it to work, you know, it was like war stories going over the crazy things that happened during this experiment. So they look back on this quite fondly. It was amazing to see. Anyway, thanks for your time and the invitation this morning, and I'm happy to take questions.
Thanks.
Yeah, so for this course, we have a homework. And in the homework somewhere, they mentioned something about storing photons. And I was wondering how people can store photons. Like, it runs away quite fast if you don't do anything to it.
Yeah. So I guess there's a few ways to do it. I'm not sure exactly what you're looking into, but you know, some can be kind of not very fancy. You can just store light in a loop, in a fiber loop. You may have a few kilometers of fiber wrapped up in a spool on a table. You can put a photon in and store it. It'll come out some time later, maybe 10 microseconds later or something like that. That might not be what you're counting as photon storage. So other methods would be to convert the photon into some other degree of freedom. So you might store a photon in the quantum state of an atom, or maybe an atomic gas, or quantum dot, or diamond. People have looked at all kinds of things that are under this class of quantum memory. And in those cases, you're usually storing the photon. You're not really, I don't know if you'd consider it storing the light itself, but you're converting the light from light base to some internal energy level of something that's not moving at the speed of light, which is nice. And then having a way to retrieve it later. So that can work. I mean, the people are looking at different ways of doing that. You know, another way of doing this, so this is a particularly dumb way of doing that, because, you know, if I put the photon in here, I have to wait for a specified amount of time for it to come out. I can't choose when I want that photon to come out of the fiber. So, you know, there are other ways you could do that. Maybe instead of a fiber loop, you put it in a cavity, and the light will bounce back and forth between two mirrors for some amount of time. And then you could have an active element like a Pockel cell inside the cavity and choose when you want that photon to come out. The problem with that, though, is loss. And it's always loss in optics. So even if you build a really nice cavity, typically you won't be able to get the light to bounce back and forth more than hundreds or thousands or 10,000 if you're amazing times, just because it's really hard to build a mirror that has 99.99999% reflectivity. But I would say those are the kinds of strategies that people use. If you want to store light for a few bounces in the cavity, it's probably the simplest thing to do. If you want to store it for longer, you really don't want it to be light anymore. So you couple it to an atomic system or something like that, and then the challenge is to try and read it out again later. But there are ways that can do that with various levels of success, I would say.
Well, thank you, then, one last time. Right.
Thank you.
You get the famous sign t-shirt.
All right.
Actually, there's going to be heaps of people like you seeing them with the sign t-shirts.
I'll be the first.
No. Because Debbie has one now, and Richard has one.
Well, thank you.
Thank you for coming.